We're starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. Here's music by Prince Jabate and Michael Yost called The Traveler. We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. In today's show, we feature the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles. The brilliant Mark Porter Zasada interviews Ron Saucy, the artistic director, and also actor and comedian Kevin Flynn. Stay tuned.
This is Mark Porter Zasada with Staying Human, a search for the mystery, poetry, and sometimes beautiful conundrums of modern life. Part of staying human, I think, in L.A. is to go to live theater. Well, serious live theater. I'm here today at the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles with artistic director Ron Saucy. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
And we are sitting in Theater One, which will soon stage Stalin's Masterclass. And we want to dive into that play a bit today, the ideas and so on. But Ron, first, just tell me a little about where the Odyssey is right now. I know theater in L.A. has been having a tough time recovering from the pandemic. How are you feeling?
Well, yeah, it is a tough time. Primarily, it's a matter of getting people back into the theater who have gotten so used to streaming and sitting home and becoming couch potatoes. For a while, it was the pandemic itself, I think, that kept people away, you know, the fear of infection. But I think now it's become a lifestyle thing where people have gotten so used to staying home that it's hard to get them out.
Well, you know, I just want to testify that live theater is a completely different thing than sitting on your couch watching TV. It's an interaction with the actors. In this play, if we can dive right in, you will meet actors portraying Stalin, Prokofiev. Tell us a little bit about this play, Stalin's Master.
Well, it's an interesting concept. It's not really historical. It's invented. But the premise is what would happen if Stalin invited the famous composers Prokofiev and Shostakovich into his office in the Kremlin, basically to teach them how to write music.
Okay.
Because he's not happy with the sort of avant-garde thing that they're doing.
All right. And he's also got his Minister of Culture there.
Shtanov, who's the funny character because he was one of the heads of the army during the Battle of Leningrad. And after the war, he was made Minister of Culture.
Oh, and obviously qualified to do that.
Exactly.
He actually had a very powerful influence on the Soviet Union.
Yes,
right? Absolutely.
He did.
So tell us just a little bit about what happens without giving away too much.
Well, the play is a mixture of both confrontational drama and almost absurdist comedy because, obviously, these two composers being invited to the Kremlin are terrified as to what might happen. This was the time right after the purges, 1948. They're invited there. They don't know why. Stalin comes out, and he's actually a very charming and even fun character in some ways. This is the playwright's idea to kind of show another side of Stalin. And so we're not seeing him with the sort of cliche, you know, tyrant that we might expect. He certainly does have those aspects at many parts in the play when it becomes frightening. But
I tell you what, let me play our audience a little snippet from a rehearsal. In this cut, Randy Lowell, in the part of Shostakovich, plays a bit from a symphonic piece, and Stalin, played by Ilya Volokh, blows a raspberry at the end.
You needed an extra instrument at the end.
Well, I did score a trombone in the piece itself. You instinctively recognized the need for it.
When did you write that?
18 years ago.
It's an insult!
Don't be so emotional, Andre. 18 years ago, it's another age, before the war. I can hardly remember what was it like to be alive back then. So much has happened.
It's part of a larger work.
Now, I might be ignorant about some music, but you three, you all come from good, solid bourgeois backgrounds. You should recognize this kind of a tricky intellectual creation we just heard. What did it mean?
It didn't mean anything!
Andre is giving in too easily. Come on!
The humor starts to ensue when Stalin, who is kind of jealous, perhaps, of artists, feels that he could have been an artist, he decides that they should all write a piece of music together that night in right. the Kremlin. And they do. And it's terrible.
Okay. All right. So I've actually read the play, and I found it really fascinating. There's a lot of themes in there. And one of them is kind of the purpose of music.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think that music, as many art forms, doesn't really have a purpose except to exist unto itself. Many people take the arts and use them for social service purposes, for political purposes, and so on. And that's certainly valid. But I think music, more than other art forms, it exists kind of on its own. I'm not sure that music has a particular political message or sociological message, whereas a play that has dialogue or a novel or whatever can have that sort of message. But in this play, Stalin regrets the fact that his country, which is now in terrible shape, a good percentage of the male population is dead, and what's left are the old people and the children.
Ah.
And Stalin's point is that in order to come back, they really need music that they can relate to, music that they can hum and sing, and the old music, the romantic music, not the sort of avant-garde stuff that Shostakovich and Prokofiev are writing. So in that sense, he feels music does have a purpose. The purpose is to the revitalization of his country.
So this is a moment when this new kind of classical music, I guess it was called neoclassical,
yeah.
Which now is, you know, part of the general canon,
right.
was shocking the world with dissonance and atonal non-melodies. I mean, a lot of people still don't like that kind of music.
Yeah, I think it's. It's not just now. It's that it's a taste to be acquired. It's the same as painting and other art forms. When people first get into classical music, invariably they like Tchaikovsky and composers that have, you know, recognizable melodic through lines. And it's after you've listened to music for a long time or become accustomed to it, I think that you become interested in people like Schoenberg or Hindemith or Stravinsky or some of these people. So it is a bit of an acquired taste. As I say, with many art forms, other art forms also.
Here, let me play another cut from a rehearsal in which the actor John Caton, who plays Shadanov, complains about another modern composer.
Suddenly, the orchestra just blasts in. And then during lyrical interludes, the drums just burst in. And during heroic passages, he plants sad, elegiac, winsome themes. Muratelli is mad, and you are no better.
In fact, in the play, Stalin asks Shostakovich and Prokofiev to write like Tchaikovsky.
Exactly.
Like, why can't you do that?
Yep.
And
yep.
Though he recognizes that they're geniuses,
yes.
nevertheless.
Yes.
And in fact, both of them did survive the
yep.
Soviet era, right?
And he appeals to them. He says, you know, you're good Russians. You can write like Tchaikovsky if you need to. You know, we need you to do this.
In fact, here is Shadanov making exactly that appeal.
Do it for the children that are working 12 hours a day in the field. Do it for the drudgery. Please, we have been at war for 50 years it'll take us to recover from this war. Do it for the people. They will appreciate it, and Russia will be thankful.
So, speaking of good Russians, why did you pick this play to produce at this moment in history?
Again, you know, I pick plays because I particularly am attracted to the theatrical essence of it, or the theatrical possibilities, or I like the message. I'm not very much of a sociologically oriented director. I kind of leave that to other theaters and to the news media. I'm not particularly interested in contemporary stuff. I'm interested in things that have a more universal message. It could be a Shakespeare play. It could be a Brecht play. Things that exist, you know, that are timeless, let's say. And I just love the message of this play. I love the confrontation between art and politics in the play. I love dealing with the dilemma of the musicians who are facing possible liquidation if they don't bow under. And I like the fact that it mixes, maybe this is the thing I like the most, that it mixes taut drama with absurdist comedy.
Yeah.
And how to find that fine line so that it's just on the edge of not being too absurdist or not being too serious, that you can't buy the other side, you know.
Yeah, okay, I see that, and I'm really interested to hear how the actors pull that off. I can see that fine line needs to be walked. But I'll tell you, you know, I am a journalist, and I found when I read the play, it really seemed very relevant to me, to the mm-hmm. moment. And part of that, the play was actually written in 1984, a very
yes.
propitious year. But at that moment in history, we really thought authoritarianism was on its way out, that democracy was triumphing around the world.
Right.
And a lot of what the play is about is not the ideology of the Soviet Union, I think, but
right.
the authoritarianism of Stalin and the way that he thinks he knows everything better than everyone else, including
yep.
music, politics. He gives health advice to the other characters. And that idea that an entire country would be controlled by a single person
yeah.
suddenly seems pretty relevant.
I think there are certainly reflections of three or four predominant political leaders, heads of various countries, to be nameless, in the play. Certainly, you can see these people reflected.
One thing that is an underlying theme is that Stalin wants Russianness in the music. He wants folk melodies. He wants that to inspire the people,
right.
which seems at odds in a way with the idea of a new world of Soviet materialism.
Well, you know, it's actually one layer lower than deeper than that, and that's he's a Georgian.
Ah.
And he prides himself in being a Georgian, and he looks down a little bit on the Russians, even though he's the head of the Soviet Union, because that they aren't more Georgian and that they repressed his Georgian roots. The Georgian people are, or at least how Stalin is portrayed here, are much earthier, are much, much closer to the sort of earthiness of like an Italian or, you know, somebody like that. And he sees the Russians as being, you know, people he has to deal with and people in a country he loves, but they're still not Georgians.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I got to pick that up when I watch the play.
Yeah.
But that idea of like being the salt of the earth,
the real
folk, is strangely important to,
yep. Yep.
I think, authoritarian figures,
yeah.
right? And the populist movements that they inspire. It's like getting back to the roots of the country.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
That's always part of it somehow.
Yeah. There's a sort of a Trumpian line in a way where he is saying you need to write folk music. And the composers say, we can't just write folk music. And he says, and Shtanov, his minister, says, why not? You're folk, aren't you? And he says, yes, we're folk. And he says, I'm folk. Stalin says, I'm folk. Stalin says, I'm the ultimate folk.
Here's another cut from a rehearsal where Stalin has been trying to teach a Georgian folk song to the group. And he gets madder and madder as they're not putting their hearts into it.
What is the matter with you, you Russian snobs? What? Are you sabotaging it? Deliberately sabotaging it? Huh? Is a simple Georgian peasant song not good enough for you? Now listen, you two. Either you're going to come off your pedestals or I'm going to take you to the Lubyanka prison and shot! So sing it again. And this time, yeah, put some feeling into it. Not bad, you see?
That's great. Yeah. And there's that sense that the artists are kind of these wimpy intellectuals. And that, and the, in fact, what Zhdanov,
yeah,
calls it formalism.
Yeah.
What they're doing is something intellectual,
yeah, yeah,
and separated from the people. It's coming right out of the academy,
right,
and so on.
Right.
And there's that endless tension between, yeah, the academic artists and the,
yeah,
real folk.
And the mixture of the characters is very interesting. You have Zhdanov, who's an ex-army person. You have Stalin, revolutionary. You have Prokofiev, who actually spent much of his life in Western Europe and became very famous, lived in France, and became kind of a darling of the West. And you have, on the other hand, Shostakovich, who has hardly left Russia. He's very much middle-class Russian and doesn't have quite the sophistication of Prokofiev. So there's an interesting contrast there between the two composers as well.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of the tension between Russia and the West that's always existed.
Yeah.
And as well as the tension between the folk and the academia that's...
Right. Right.
Existed as certainly throughout my lifetime.
But I can't help thinking of Trump when he says, "I'm the ultimate folk."
Right, yeah.
I'm more folk than any of you.
The man from coming down the gold elevator in,
right,
New
right,
York. Yeah,
right.
Okay. We won't get too political. there is something very Shakespearean, actually, in the figure of Stalin, to me, in this play.
He's a bit of a tragic figure, really.
He is. He is. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, he in his early life, similar to Hitler, actually, in his early life, his kind of tendencies were quashed. He started in a seminary, as did Hitler, and Georgian roots, his love of Georgian music, Georgian poetry, and so on, were squashed by the priests that ran the seminary.
Huh.
Who were trying to make everybody more Russian, not Georgian. Out of that came his revolutionary zeal, as at least according to this playwright. What has happened now in his later life is, and we never see this side of Stalin portrayed in other works that I know of, but in his later life, he really regrets the fact that he killed so many people, that he was responsible, not necessarily that he killed them all, he killed a number of them, but also that he was simply responsible. He was the head of the country during the Second World War, and then millions died. And he sees himself as a kind of, at one point he says, "I have to keep living because I have to live out all the lives of the people that have died under my stewardship." And he sees himself as a Jesus Christ sort of figure, a sacrificial figure.
That comes out in the play.
Yeah.
There's a sense of royalty, like he is the country,
right,
in a way.
Right, yes.
And I mean, that's very Shakespearean, too. And
then there's a lot of comedy. A lot of comedy.
Okay, folks.
There's a Mutt and Jeff thing between Mutt and Jeff. That's an old image, I'm sorry. For younger listeners, let's say a Laurel and Hardy image, even between Stalin and Zhdanov, where Zhdanov is the fall guy that always is the butt of the jokes, and Stalin gets to play good cop, and Zhdanov plays bad cop. And there's, of course, the rivalry between the two composers, and there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of interesting, given the theme of the play.
And they play a lot of music.
And they play a lot of music live, yeah.
Lives? Are all the actors pianists?
That's a secret.
Oh, that's a secret. Okay, sorry.
If you see the play, you will find out how we do it.
Okay. I was really wondering when I was reading the script, how are they going to pull this off? But we'll leave that to Hollywood to figure out. But you know, Stalin was, in fact, for those who need reminding, he was the leader of the Soviet Union from 1924 until he died in 1953. And people estimate that he was responsible for as many as 20 million deaths.
20 million. That's the number that's kicked around.
That's the number that's kicked around.
And interestingly, he died on the same day Prokofiev died.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
A couple years after the setting of the play.
These are people in the Soviet Union who set out to remake every aspect of people's lives, including all the arts. I mean, the way people lived, the way they, not just the way they derived income, but everything that they thought, everything that they felt.
Yeah.
So he felt, so Stalin and his minister felt that they needed to call in these composers to get them, because they were the geniuses. Yeah. They knew they were the geniuses.
Again,
of
reflections of Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
You know, Hitler tried to remake all the arts and, you know, go back to the old arts and get rid of the avant-garde and get people to write music that was acceptable and do paintings that were acceptable and so on.
Why are authoritarians against the avant-garde? It seems universally true.
Yeah, well, that's happening today in our country too, isn't it?
It is.
There's a big move toward you know, the good old days, which maybe weren't so good old. Yeah, I don't know why that is. I guess there's more security in it that one often doesn't understand new arts and new ideas and new politics and new science. And
I think we all feel that pull, though. I mean, there are lines that the dictator says in this play that, like, I go, yeah, I don't understand the music either.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he says, you know, play a melody that inspires me.
Right.
Sit down and play a melody that inspires me.
That's right.
You know, and they can't do it.
Yeah.
Interestingly.
I'm very much into music. I'm a vinyl junkie. And my girlfriend, when I'm playing music, she just goes crazy because she can't stand the music I'm playing. You know, play something, you know, play some Mozart, play some Tchaikovsky, play some Rachmaninoff, you know, instead of the stuff you're playing.
What do you play?
Oh, I play a lot of the Russian, Shostakovich and Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Bartok, most of the contemporary people I like, Schoenberg sometimes, Hindemith.
So one of the complaints that Stalin and his minister have is that music is depressing.
Yeah.
That it's melancholy and that it's, you know, there's great lines in here and about how it brings down people's spirits and why do you want to do that to
right.
them? And it's kind of true, right?
Ashtanov says, this is the greatest, you're living in the greatest times ever. This is Russia, the greatest place, the greatest times ever. How can you be so depressed to write that dismal music?
And it is kind of depressing, right? It is.
Well, it's, I don't know if it's depressing.
Expresses the anxiety of the 20th century.
It shakes one's desire for form, I think. Ooh. When you're listening to a melody, you know where it's going. You can be with it and all that. If you're listening to some of this more modern music, the unexpected is constantly happening. You know, you don't quite know where it's going.
Right.
And it doesn't have much melody.
It's interesting to me that in the play, neither the composers defend their music. They just, this is just like what we do.
Yeah.
It's just what we feel.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Prokofiev is an interesting case, too, because early in his career, he wrote a lot of the kind of music that Stalin likes. But then he evolved from there and he started writing other things. And, you know, he wrote interesting ballets and Peter and the Wolf and all these things that are very melodic.
Right.
And Stalin wants him to go back to that. Shostakovich is a little different. Shostakovich is a younger, newer breed, and he's been brought up more on more avant-garde music.
Artists in all fields were birthing the idea of the avant-garde, that you could do anything.
Yeah.
You could do anything. Yeah. And they won in every case.
And they what?
They won. Like,
yeah.
You know, there were attempts to censor art. And the Nazis tried to censor it. And, you know, television tried to censor it. And they won in every single case.
Well, you know, it seems to me to go up and down. Like, I know when I first started doing theater many, many, many years ago, I was sort of partnered with an older woman who had grown up in Germany and then fled when Hitler came in. But she used to say, all the stuff you guys are doing now in the 60s, you know, we did that in the 20s. You know, that was part of what the 20s were. And then the 20s passed and it kind of disappeared. It became mainstream. And I think much of the 60s now have become mainstream. You know, it doesn't quite have that rebellious sort of aspect.
But it's interesting to me that you actually are a Stravinsky, Prokofiev, Shostakovich fan.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. Rite of Spring. The first time I heard Rite of Spring when I was in college, I immediately went to the record store and I said, what else do you have like this? And they said, there's nothing like this.
Right. Okay, great. Well, tell me, are there other things that, you know, themes that you'd like to bring up? Or
well, I just, you know, I hope people will come and enjoy it and know that it's not a heavy evening. It's a provocative evening in terms of the ideas, and it is confrontational and scary sometimes, but also it is largely very funny, a very funny take on a character that we know so little about. You know, plays are not done about Stalin.
It's kind of outrageous to have him as, he's really the central character of the play.
Absolutely.
He's really the one that we get the deepest insight.
Yeah. And as you say, there's live music in the evening. That's fun. You'll find out how it's done.
Okay.
But there is live music and great, as I say, great fun.
Okay, fabulous, fabulous. Well, what else is coming up at the theater?
We have a Sondheim evening coming up later down the road, and we have a Noel Coward play, Designed for a Living, coming up, and we have a really strange, interesting African-American play, and I always forget the title. It's very interesting. It's set at a skateboarding place.
Ah, that would be Kill Move Paradise, which takes place in the afterlife and on a skateboard ramp.
It's a very expressionistic, crazy kind of a play, and I'm looking forward to that. And then we're also going to do, I think, an evening of absurdity, of absurd plays, focusing on the Polish playwright Mrożek. And we have a wonderful one-man show, guy who comes here regularly. I think this is his fifth time now, an Irish performer named Pat Kinavane, and he comes here for like a couple of weeks, and he's an extraordinary performer. His physicality, his ability at mime, his ability at various other kind of art forms, all kind of squashed into one performer, is quite incredible, and I really recommend that people see him. Pat Kinavane.
Super. Well, the website, if you don't know, is Odyssey Theater, T-R-E at the end.
Yes,
dot com. The season is really, really interesting coming up. Get out there into live theater, folks.
Yes. Freedom from your couch.
Stalin's Masterclass runs April 13th through May 26th, possibly another week longer. Yeah. Check the website, get your tickets, and fun as well as philosophy.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you.
All right. This has been Mark Porter Zasada with Staying Human. You can find me at stayinghuman.net. And to play us out, here again is actor and pianist Randy Lowell playing Shostakovich on the stage. There's another show coming up at the Odyssey you shouldn't miss. A short run of Kevin Flynn's terrific one-man piece, Fear of Heights, returns from April 5 to 14. Kevin's very funny and insightful show is about his magic carpet ride from a working-class family to, well, almost A-list stardom in Hollywood. Almost. We couldn't resist replaying part of an interview I did with Kevin back in September that includes the moment he decided to step off the magic carpet at the age of 29. Today, I'm with Kevin Flynn, whose one-man show, Fear of Heights, is currently playing at the Odyssey in West LA. I saw it last night. I loved it. I wanted to talk to him right away because the theme of the show is kind of staying human. And so, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. I'm glad you made the show last night and made me feel human.
All right. Good. Well, the show opens with a very famous photograph.
Right.
And maybe you can tell us about that.
Well, the famous photograph is it's called Men Having Lunch on a Beam. It's that picture that most people know. It's that famous ironworker picture where this steel beam is across the Manhattan skyline. There's 69 floors above the city streets, and the furthest on the right is a man holding a small bottle, and that turns out to be my grandfather, a man named Paddy Flynn. That's where the story starts, basically. And now I'm here doing this.
So Kevin is not a steel worker. Kevin is a well-known actor, stand-up comedian, writer, now playwright as well. You may know him from Sex and the City as the boyfriend of Charlotte.
Charlotte's boyfriend, yeah.
Boyfriend. So young, incredibly good-looking.
Yeah, and it was actually the first time she was topless in the show.
Yes, you will get insider tidbits about Hollywood like that, but that isn't what the show's about, and it's not what we really want to dive into today.
Edit that out.
Let's get back to that picture, because a lot of the show is about your growing up in a steelworker family in New York.
Yeah.
Right? The kind of the ethos of that, the lost ethos, maybe, of that time?
Sure. Well, it's basically, I don't think I was supposed to be a third generation iron worker. My parents were basically, my grandfather was that man on that iron beam, and we were the Flynns. We were iron workers. My grandfather, my father, my uncles, my cousins, everybody was an iron worker. We were all expected to be iron workers. So, but I grew up with this sort of respect the working man mentality, where people work hard and you come home and you provide for your family. And my father was very honest and a hardworking man. And so I thought about my grandfather, and then I thought about my father, and then I thought about me, and then I realized it was for my daughter, to let maybe my daughter see that I watched the sacrifices that my grandfather and my father made, basically on my behalf. Here I am, an actor, a writer, a comedian. I didn't have to be a steelworker because of the hard work they put in for me in that way, the gift that they gave me.
So I want to talk in this show a little bit about that previous time and something that's kind of been lost. And you do a wonderful impression of your father and some of the things that he said about his work, about bringing
a my dad was, he was a big guy. My father was 6'2", and so was my grandfather. I'm 5'9", so he was this big sweetheart of a guy, though. But he had this funny way about him where he'd always be like, they'd get hurt at work, and he'd be like, ah, Kev, part of the package, pal. Part of the package, pal. It's what you can do. It's all you can do, just part of the package. So he always had these sayings that he would repeat to me over and over, like, nothing worse than a man who's lazy, pal. Nothing worse than a man who's lazy. Nothing worse than a man who's cheap. Nothing. Terrible trait, pal. Nothing worse. So he kind of kept me on that respect the working man, hard work, the sacrifices that people make.
So you can hear in there that Irish accent.
Oh, yeah.
And the audience, I'm sure, knows that photo of the steel guy sitting on the steel beam, 1932, Rockefeller Center being built.
Yeah.
And far on the right is a aging iron worker with four fingers.
Four fingers on his left hand, yeah.
And he's holding a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your grandfather.
Yep.
Paddy
so Flynn.
So I want to hear a little of Paddy Flynn.
Paddy was really off the boat, and so his accent was a lot, deeper. And when my father wanted to go to college, become an architect, my grandfather would be like, "Well, boy, college. There's nothing like college. You know, no need for college. The boy's going to climb the beam and climb the steel with the rest of the family when he graduates from high school. He's going up on a beam, climbing the family steel." you know. Then I do my other grandfather, who was from Northern Ireland, so his accent was a little different. Okay. But I broke my leg playing soccer in two places, and he comes running out. He's like, "All right, now get up. It could be worse. Could be worse. Could be a lot worse than that. You could have broken both legs. How's that for worse? Could be worse than that, even. You could be dead. Dead and buried. Lying 6 feet under the ground. Looking up, saying, oh boy, how I wish I was back up there now with my one little wee broken leg." And my dad's on the other side of the field. "Get up, you fairy. That's what you get for kicking it."
So, by the way, if you go to the show, Kevin conjures all kinds of characters from not just his family, but from Hollywood. And I know in your stand-up routines, it's a lot character-based of kind sure. of people you've met and so on. So
yeah.
That's a teaser. And we're going to hopefully get more teasers like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But before we, you know, move on from, I'm kind of obsessed with this idea that, like, people used to have a respect for work, mm-hmm. like working people,
right.
that they don't have anymore. You know, like you think about every Hollywood movie where, you know, they're working a menial job and then they discover their talent and they move on, you know, spectacularly,
yeah.
right? And they leave that behind. And, you know, your own story is a little bit there, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, so I have this book, and I wanted to surprise you by showing you this. This is these are photographs by a guy named Irving Penn, very famous photographer, from the 1950s. It's called Small Trades. And this is from an exhibit that was at the Getty a few years ago. And he wanted to show the dignity that was in the faces of people doing work in those days, because he knew it was disappearing.
Right. Really, in the 50s,
In the 50s, he said, these are the last people who understand really what blue-collar work means and who respect themselves. And if you look at the faces of these people, you know, there's a stone cutter and a hod carrier, and there's probably steel workers in here, iron workers.
Yeah.
But there's, like, they have this pride.
Craftsmen, and they took pride in their work. You know, it's funny. My father has a theory. He felt that after World War II, people were so thankful to have a roof over their heads, a place to send their kids to school, a car in the driveway, food on the table. He felt the further we got away from World War II, the less people would understand the sacrifices that we all made for each other as a nation,
yeah.
as a world. And I think, unfortunately, I feel like some of that's coming true. I don't think we're, you know, I think with a lot of times work, the pride that goes into work, now people just say, well, how much do you make? How much do you make?
Yeah.
And it's the hedge funds and it's the Wall Street and they're making all the money. And you're sort of like, well, but someone who bakes bread, someone who builds buildings, somebody, you know, like you're talking to you had a deep sea diver, one of those pictures, a chef. It's like people take pride in their work, and it would sustain a family. And now it's, some of these jobs are very hard to raise a family, raise yourself if you're a chef or at a restaurant, a cook. I see these taxi drivers in New York City, they're working 2-3 jobs and they still can't live in the city. You know, it's just a hustle now all the time, multi-gigs. And I just feel it's too bad, you know. And so this whole thing about work is part of what's in this play, because I think, you know, boy, they worked hard to allow me to have other opportunities. But I have to learn how to do my job and take pride in it and work hard at it, you know.
So in the play, I guess it's a play. It's the whole thing's kind of a memoir,
right?
A fun memoir, I should point out.
Yeah.
And the title Fear of Heights comes from the fact that the reason you didn't become an iron worker, the sole reason apparently at the time, was that you were afraid of heights.
Right.
You wouldn't tell anybody. So you said you're Plan B.
My plan B was, well, my first was to be a soccer player. I wanted to be a professional athlete. I did that. And I talk about, you know, how I couldn't be an iron worker. So what could I do? And I had this moment with myself when I was about 10, thinking like, oh, this panic set in. I'm afraid of heights. I can't tell anybody. And how can I really be a Flynn, this proud ironworking tradition family, if I'm afraid of heights? And I didn't want anybody to know that. And so I basically, in the play, you see where I kind of say, well, what can I do? And I decide, oh, become rich and famous. That's what I'll do. You know, it's just like, you know.
So you actually achieved fame and fortune, unlike most of us who attempt that. Not usually as our plan B. Usually our plan B is something else. So in the story, and I'm not going to have you trace your whole career.
Yeah.
But give us the 30-second
Well, as we all know, you have to have a lot of plans in this world because things change all the time. Yeah, I played professional soccer for a couple of years. I got drafted out of college, and that was wonderful. But no fame and fortune there. Soccer in the late 80s was not the most popular thing around. But I was on the road a lot, traveling around the country, and I started to write, keep a journal, and try to make the guys laugh. And I thought, I really enjoy this. I had always watched stand-up comedy thinking, I think I can do this. I think Catholic school was a great training ground for trying to make friends laugh under repressed sort of...
Under repressed conditions.
Repressed conditions. Yeah, I said oppressed. Repressed conditions. And so when I had a chance, I went to BU, to graduate school. I took the assistant coaching job there, the soccer coach for the soccer team. And the comedy scene in Boston was just on fire. I started to hang out at the comedy clubs, and clubs were packed. Started to write stand-up, and got up on stage and wound up winning a competition. And so I won, and I became a professional comic at that point.
And the story that you told was about your Irish family. And
on stage, yeah.
On stage. So yeah. You were doing those impressions of your family. And
right. Yeah, my grandfather time. and one of my first stand-up bits, or actually the very first stand-up bit I ever wrote was about my family, about my dad. And I say I was from a very conflicted upbringing. And this is after you already hear how I had a pretty nice upbringing, right?
Yeah, you had a nice family.
Very nice family. And so I say, oh, it was terrible. It was conflicted. I was a soccer player. My father was a football player. He didn't understand soccer at all. He would just come to my games. He'd stand on the sidelines for 90 minutes, keep yelling, pick up the ball. Pick up the ball. They're all kicking around like a bunch of fairies. Pick it up and hit somebody. You're an American, for God's sakes.
It's hard work.
Yes.
Being an actor and a comedian, and, you know, it's not like there's some magic talent that fairy dust that comes down and makes it all happen, right? But
I basically, when I started to get on television a little bit as a stand-up comic, I moved out west and I started to audition for things. And one of the things that started to really happen for me was television hosting. So I wound up, the first television show I had was a show called Road to the World Cup. On ABC Sports with Brent Musburger. Uh-huh. So I guess, and I sent a tape into ESPN as well, you know, with some of my soccer highlights from my playing career and my stand-up comedy. ESPN hired me as well. Then I shot a morning show pilot with Joy Behar. And then I got a show called Go For It on the Discovery Channel, which ran for a couple of years, which was wonderful. I traveled the world, and I did all these scary adventures, and I have a fear of heights. So
you talk in the show, you know, about making a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
About checks piling up on the dresser that you didn't even have time to cash.
Right.
And then there's a moment where you have kind of a reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little about that moment and how it changed your life.
Well, story. I've always set goals for myself. I'm very goal-oriented, and I was working very hard to sort of make this a big jump into sort of a network career and, you know, big fame and fortune. I had it on a little bit of a scale. You know, you said I had it, but I felt I had it on a small scale. Mm. Wasn't enough. Sort of had this insatiable appetite to continue to move and do it. And I had even avoided relationships because I thought they got in the way of me achieving these goals. And the play, you know, and in my life, basically what happens is right when I start to get successful, my father has lung cancer, and then I get robbed. At gunpoint.
Right. So before we get to that, very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Exciting for you.
Terrifying moment.
Terrifying. Yeah, that's a better word.
So he got lung cancer from asbestos.
Asbestos, yeah.
From working on those skyscrapers.
Yeah.
In this very demanding, the job that we're respecting here and all that. And
right.
You talk about that. He got it.
Yeah. Well, he worked amongst asbestos. I tell it in the play. I remember my father telling me when I was a kid, they were giving the men an extra 50 cents a day for a quart of milk at the end of the workday. So the theory was that it would coat their throats and stomachs from all the asbestos they'd inhaled over the course of the day, which was absurd.
Right.
We think about now. And this is in the 70s. So, and my father was always like, hard day's work, honest day's work. You know, it's okay, honest day's work. Part of the package, you know, if you get hurt once in a while, part of the package. And so I mentioned it early in the play, and then sure enough, he, you know, has lung cancer, asbestosis. And they give the man just a couple of months to live, my father.
Yeah.
From an honest day's work, I say.
And then that same day, was that the same day?
Same weekend. So it happened, in the middle of the week, I get this call. you know, the thing is, I break up with my girlfriend. We break up. And basically, she wants to get married. I don't. I still have so many things I want to do in my life. And she, well, we break up. And 2 days later, my father has lung cancer, this diagnosis. And so she flies out to see me, to comfort me. And it's weird because we've broken up. We had this big breakup. And now my father has this terrible death sentence. And I'm sort of at a loss. I'm in a really weird place. And we have a dinner here in L.A. and on a Friday night. And I drive back to my house. And we get robbed at gunpoint, walking to the front door. And I get pistol whipped. And they pull the gun. They push the gun to the back of my head as I'm lying on the ground. And I thought I was dead. I thought I was dead. And I thought, I'm going to die before my father does, this life that he's lived and everything he's done. And here I am, I'm going to die in my own driveway. And what have I done in this world other than thinking about myself? Hmm. And I thought, you know, here's a man who's given so much to me and to my sisters and to my mom and to his friends and his other family. And it's like, so I just sort of felt a bit shallow lying on that ground. And I thought I had made some bad choices in my life. I thought maybe some selfish choices. And I had a moment of just feeling like, wow, what am I doing? Is this success? Then? I was probably 29.
Okay.
Yeah, 30, maybe just 30. And I thought, what am I doing? And I decided at that moment to say, I have to really realign my priorities. And my priority at that point was like, get married, start a family, and give back to what had been given to me as a young man growing up. And so I get married, and that doesn't really quite work out. As we all know, you know, when you get married, the fairy tale's over and the hard work begins. So I have a beautiful daughter out of it, and then it becomes about, I was laughing with someone after the show. Sometimes, you know, if you're in a bad marriage and you have a child, it's almost like a hostage situation. You would never really put up with certain things if you were single. Yeah. But because you have a child, you say you kind of look past your own needs and your own wants. Ultimately, it was the choices I made to sort of step away from the business a little bit because it took me away from this my daughter. And
so in the show, we learned not only did you step away, but, you know, your agent was calling you with major parts and you were turning them down until indeed they dropped you.
At the end there.
Uh-huh. But that moment, it's very interesting to me. You know, there's a phrase that I read in a newspaper article one time. It was about a homeless guy. But the writer in this moment of poetry said, this man aspired to normalcy as to greatness.
Oh, I like that.
And that phrase has haunted me for 20 years since I read that. But I think about that, and I think about that with Hollywood folks, you know?
Yeah.
That, like, for the rest of us, no fame, fortune, not, you know, ESPN commentators or boyfriends of women of Charlotte. That if we ever achieve that, that would be the ultimate.
Right.
Right? And, you know, one learns not only that people who achieve that usually don't feel like, you know, you don't feel like you made
there. Right.
You were there. I have a friend who's a psychiatrist who said he had a patient who had won an Oscar. And in therapy, the famous director said, yeah, but that was 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Right? Yeah. But that idea of aspiring to normalcy, you hear that?
I think that actually ties back to your pictures of these workers where this normal, wonderful life that they live, they raise a family, they bake bread, and they, you know, I think it's just, it's normal.
Yeah.
And so, and when, how come normal has not been enough now for people in lives in certain things? And why do we admire fame so much? And if, like, I sometimes want to say, amazing, he's working. How's his family life? You know, how are his kids? Do his kids know him? Do they see him? Because those kids only get one shot of being raised. And it's tough enough to be a famous person's kid, I would imagine. Never mind if they're not even there most of the time. So these are the choices we make. I have always found that sometimes I've found overachieving people don't have really a balance in their life sometimes. And that's what I've tried to aspire to at that point, to try and say, how can I, you know, release my creative instincts and do what I do, but be the best father I can be for this little person who I brought into this world.
You know what else I was thinking of when I was watching the show is the way modern people are forced to make up their lives, like, from scratch.
Yeah.
Like, your father, your grandfather, like, they didn't have to make up their lives, right? They knew what they were. That you go out, you earn a living, you have kids. Your grandfather had, you were the 21st grandchild.
Yeah, there was a lot of them after me, too. He had six kids, so.
Oh, okay, there you
go. Six kids, yeah. And so they all had kids, and that was the whole deal.
Yeah, but they didn't have to, like, wake up in the morning every day and say, how am I going to optimize my life?
Right, yeah.
Right?
Right.
You think about that. Oh, my gosh. You know, we live with that in this crazy way.
You put your pants on and you went to work, you know? And I also say for my grandfather, even the right to do that dangerous job, he had to fight for it because they had to fight with their hands to be unionized. They had to fight people, literally, to get to a job site, to get, you know, I mean, it's just unfathomable to me in our generation. It's just, you know. I know a guy who actually, his kids were in the car in Hollywood here, and they were driving, and he was a director, and the kids were talking in the back, and all the kids are tangentially in some way related to Hollywood, and they were talking about whose father had better box office draw that weekend. And actually, the mother was driving, and she came home and said, "We're moving. We're going to move out of the city because this is ridiculous." 10-year-old kids talking about whose father did better at the box office that week. You know,
there's this moment where you've decided to go to get married.
Yeah.
And you're on your honeymoon in Italy.
Yeah.
And
as soon as I get there, there's an urgent message waiting for me at the front desk. And I'm fearing about my father and his battle with lung cancer. But I run down to the front desk, and it's from my agent. And it's really kind of my big break. It's turns out to be something, a big network show. But I'm on the first night of my honeymoon, and the agent says to me, "You got to come home and meet with these people. They're making a decision in 2 days. It's down to two people. You're both my clients. You got to get home." And I have suddenly this dilemma, you know, where I'm like, wow, wait a minute. I'm, you know, great. Okay, definitely. Because that's how I'd always been, like, yeah, jump in the plane and go and do it. But I'm married now. So I have to go back and talk to my new wife, and it does not go well at all.
On your wedding night.
On my wedding night. Yeah, to my honeymoon. First night of my honeymoon. So it became a problem right away. I thought I was, you know, in an untenable situation right away, and it was a warning shot, really. So I don't go back. I don't go back for it, and it turned out to be a big network show that's been running for years. So we just won't say the name. It's a big reveal, and it's been going on for a long time, the show. So it would have been fame and fortune basically for me. But
yeah,
but I got a daughter instead, that's worth, you know, that's worth more money than anything in the world.
The greatness of normalcy.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
That's as much of the show as we can give away in this round, and I'll say thanks again to Kevin.
Thank you, Mark. This is wonderful. Let's all try to stay and remain human.
Kevin Flynn reprises his one-man show, Fear of Heights, at the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles, April 5 through April 14th. Don't miss it. Once again, this has been Mark Porter Zasada with Staying Human. You can find me at stayinghuman.net.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, we featured the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles. The brilliant Mark Porter Zasada interviewed Ron Saucy, the artistic director, and then interviewed Kevin Flynn, who has a show starting April 5th called Fear of Heights. We started the show with a piece called The Traveler by Prince Djibouti and Michael Yost. We'll be back next week with the very finest of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.